Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, July 16, 2019. A South Sudanese journalist is blocked from traveling to Nairobi. And the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan urges leaders in Sudan to move on with power-sharing deal.
We had a very good discussion about the process that's underway to try to reach agreement on forming the civilian-led transitional government that the Sudanese people have been waiting for too long at this point.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's National Security Service official at Juba International Airport blocked a journalist from traveling to Nairobi on Monday. The editor-in-chief of the Al-Watan Arabic newspaper says an officer with the National Security Service ordered him to disembark from a Kenya Airways plane destined to Nairobi. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
Michael Christopher, editor-in-chief of Al-Watan Daily, says he and his wife boarded a plane for Nairobi yesterday when he heard a voice calling him to get off the plane. Speaking in Arabic, Christopher says he was headed to Nairobi for a medical checkup and to finish his studies.
I was already in the plane, and when the plane was about to take off, I was called using the plane microphone that, "Michael, come down." I went and got the director of national security for the airport that he got an order from the headquarters of the national security that, "Michael shouldn't travel."
Christopher says he asked the unidentified national security officer why he was told to disembark, but received no explanation. Christopher says the officer told him the orders came straight from the deputy director of the national security and that he should report to national security headquarters the following day.
He didn't tell me the reason why he prevented me and he took my ticket. Now my ticket and passport are with them at the national security until I find out what is the problem. But nothing happened to me.
Christopher says he went to the national security office today, but the director for information was unreachable. He says he hopes the same thing doesn't happen to any other journalist because it is every citizen's right to travel in and out of the country freely. Josephine Achiro, Secretary General for the Association for Media Development in South Sudan, who spoke to Christopher after the incident, says there was no reason to pull him off the plane.
This act is inhuman. Christopher is a South Sudanese, he's a national South Sudanese who loves to serve his country, who loves to serve his people with information that will save life. What happened to Christopher that leads to his newspaper or the newspaper he works for being closed? To us as Amdis, I don't know if there is anything beyond than that, but what he did, writing about what is happening in Sudan, is not really a crime.
Kwang Pal, chairman of the National Editors Forum in South Sudan, says the forum is investigating the matter.
We will find out, get more information about on the reason why he was denied or why he was removed from the plane. Otherwise, it could be political, it could be his work, but I cannot tell you what really is the issue, but it's a concern.
The media authority suspended Al-Watan from publishing 5 months ago after Christopher wrote an opinion piece about the Sudan protest. The media authority asked Christopher to apologize, but he declined. Shortly thereafter, the media authority suspended the newspaper. Christopher says after receiving threats from unidentified persons several months ago, he fled to Egypt. Today, Christopher says he returned to South Sudan 3 months ago to resume publishing his newspaper. Media authority officials informed Christopher they will make a final ruling tomorrow on whether to reopen his paper. An official with the national security denied having any knowledge of Christopher being pulled off a plane. Christopher says his passport was not returned when he went to national security headquarters as instructed. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
The U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan says the Trump administration is concerned about the situation in Sudan and wants to see a tangible commitment from the Sudanese military leaders towards forming a civilian-led government. Speaking to reporters in Khartoum last night, Ambassador Donald Booth says Sudanese are waiting for change. Michael Atit has a story for VOA from Khartoum.
Special Envoy Donald Booth says he's here in Khartoum to hear from the parties about how they intend to move the political process forward and how they can be helped to reach an agreement. Booth emerged from a meeting with Abdul Fattah Burhan, the head of the Sudanese Transitional Military Council, last evening to say he believes the only way forward is a civilian-led transitional government in Sudan.
We had a very good discussion about the process that's underway to try to reach agreement on forming the civilian-led transitional government that the Sudanese people have been waiting for too long at this point. And we addressed a number of issues, discussed them.
Booth says both the Transitional Military Council and the Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition should not ignore the thirst for change among Sudanese protesters who had been on the streets since December. He says he hopes his presence in Sudan will help the Sudanese leaders to realize that vision.
And I'm hopeful that in the very near future that the Sudanese people can have their dreams of a transitional government led by civilians and independent prime minister, that will become a reality. And that's why I'm here in Sudan, is to talk with all of the parties to show that the United States is interested and committed to helping.
The special envoy said the U.S. is committed to mobilizing resources around the world to help Sudan move towards economic development, but first, a civilian-led government must be in place.
The United States very much wants to see Sudan turn the corner that was begun by the protests on the street in December and carried through by the Sudanese people. And I'm also working with the other international partners of Sudan to ensure that if the Sudanese do achieve this breakthrough, that they will be supported by the international community.
Speaking to reporters in Brussels yesterday, ahead of a meeting of the European Union Foreign Affairs Council, Finland's Foreign Affairs Minister Pekka Haavisto said the EU will provide financial support to Sudan if the U.S. lifted it from the list of countries that sponsor terrorism. Haavisto says the EU would also like to see a civilian-led government in Sudan becomes reality soon. Speaking in Arabic, Abdul Basit Idris, a Sudanese journalist and a political analyst, says promises of economic support are not healthy because they usually never see the light of a day.
These kinds of promises are just for diplomatic reasons, and as Sudanese, we don't trust them. In 2005, there was an international economic summit for Sudan after the peace agreement, but nothing was implemented, and the United States went further, splitting Sudan into two failed countries.
Ambassador Booth is expected to join the Transitional Military Council and the Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition tonight as the two sides try to finalize discussions on the political agreement, including a decision on who should have the power to hire and fire high-ranking officials in key government agencies and departments. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Aid workers in Uganda said armed conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo has doubled the flow of refugees since June, straining humanitarian funding. Many of the DRC refugees braved the harsh waters of Lake Albert on the Ugandan border to make the crossing to safety. Halima Athumani reports from the landing site in southwestern Uganda.
54-year-old Mwamoyo Chantal has lived in a Ugandan refugee settlement for 6 years now, after fleeing violence in Congo's North Kivu province. When she arrived, Chantal found long-lost family members who had fled the same region during what's known as the First Congo War in 1996 and 1997. Chantal explains why she thinks fighting has persisted since the end of the 32-year rule of the late Mobutu Sese Seko. He held the country like he owned it all alone. During the fighting, it seems they discovered that Congo has minerals, so everyone is now fighting for the wealth in Congo. DRC refugees continue to arrive at the Ugandan border by the boatload across Lake Albert. Refugee Joshua Oshaki says he lost contact with his wife during fighting in the DRC's Ituri region, but managed to escape with his two children. In the beginning, the conflict was tribal. Different tribes would fight each other. The Hema and the Lendu would be joined by the Wangiti and other tribes. They would kill each other. Currently, the fighting has faces of government soldiers and civilians. Even as the DRC's people struggle to survive, the country is considered one of the richest in the world in mineral wealth. Critics say few benefits are harnessed by the state for ordinary people, while mining companies and the elite become rich. Dismas Nkunda is the executive director of the watchdog group Atrocities Watch Africa.
Who supports the strong militiamen, the individuals who hold sway in the vast lands of controlling properties and areas? Who does that? So certainly foreign powers are involved. Certainly countries neighboring DRC are involved, all of them. They have interests in a DRC that is not as stable as it should be.
Last week, Presidents Paul Kagame of Rwanda, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, Yao Lourenco of Angola, and Congo's President Felix Tshisekedi held a meeting in Luanda to discuss, among other things, the security situation in the Great Lakes region. The three countries, plus Burundi and Eritrea, escalated the 1996 conflict in Congo, then known as Zaire, either by sending state forces or backing militia groups to defeat various rebel groups based in Congo. It's not clear yet whether the presidential summit will yield any effort to end the suffering of Congolese people who have to flee their homes. Halima Afmani for VA News, Changwali, Uganda.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at blood shortage in South Sudan. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you want people to remember you for?
I want them to remember me for how much I've imparted in their life, as when they needed me, or providing help for them in so many ways.
I think more than anything, I want people to remember me for leaving a legacy. I want people to remember me as someone who was there for other people.
I want people to remember me as a honest person, an honest man, and a generous man. I like giving. The same way I like receiving, the same way I like to work hard. Yeah, I want people to remember me as a man who was too honest and generous.
I want to put up this thing for a girl child, whereby we have platforms to talk to different girls about our values and what we are capable of doing.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America, and it's time for our Tuesday Health segment. And today we are talking about a blood shortage in South Sudan. Health Ministry and UN officials say there is a shortage of blood in health facilities across the country. A health officer with the World Health Organization in South Sudan says the country needs at least 120,000 units of blood each year, but officials are able to collect 7,000 units only. The official says they are appealing to the public to regularly donate blood to save lives in South Sudan. Ding Magot reports for VOA from Juba.
Moses Gamba lies quietly on his hospital bed at the Freedom Hospital in Juba, waiting for an operation. Gamba, who suffers from diabetes and has a wound on his right foot, has been admitted at the hospital for 13 days. Doctors have told Gamba he needs an operation to remove a septic leg. Before he goes for an operation, Gamba must first receive 3 units of blood. He has so far received 1 unit of blood, but doctors still need 2 units for the operation.
I am here. They have not done the amputation. My blood was little and they need 3 liters. They said I should be given 2 liters of blood, and if my blood level has increased, they can do the operation.
James Chitska Chitsva, a technical officer for blood and transfusion safety at the World Health Organization in South Sudan, says the shortage of blood is caused by the fact that there are too few voluntary regular donors to provide regular blood supplies to the blood bank.
In 2013, there were 65 voluntary and paid blood donations. And this was the only record we could get here in Juba, Juba Teaching Hospital. The blood transfusion center had not been opened yet. It was not operational. But by 2018, that number had gone to 1,754. And the interesting thing is, this 1,764 might be impressive, but no, we should be doing much better.
Narik Peter Wall, the National Blood Transfusion Services Project Manager, says the demand for blood in South Sudan remains high because there are several diseases and conditions that increase the need for the blood transfusion.
We can collect 200, 300 per day or for 2 days. In 1 week, it's all gone because we have, you know, this is a tropical country. We are in a tropical area. So we have malaria, which is a risk for us. The demand is really high on that. And we have women that are in labor. And sometimes they need blood because their blood can just drop for some other reasons. Children who are malnourished, they need blood. And the demand is really high. That's despite the people who are getting in a car accidents, a motorbike, and wounded people, you know, like soldiers. So there is many ways that people need to be transfused.
The World Health Organization says people in South Sudan who require blood transfusion are women with complications of pregnancy, people with severe trauma following man-made and natural disasters, women who are giving birth, and children with severe anemia, people undergoing surgical procedures, and cancer patients. The South Sudan Blood Transfusion Services has established 5 centers where volunteers can donate blood. These are in Juba, Torit, Yambio, Rumbek, and Wau. But Moni Tabitha Emmanuel, a blood donor recruitment officer at South Sudan Red Cross, says very few people are willing to donate blood, leaving patients who need a blood transfusion at the risk of death.
At times you come out with very little number of people who have donated blood. At times you can even come up with zero, mainly because people are complaining of the economic crisis right now in South Sudan. People say they don't eat well, so they do not have blood. They have that kind of mindset that because they do not eat food that other rich people could be eating, it means they do not have blood. And also some of the cultural beliefs that they are not supposed to donate blood because they come from a different region. They're not supposed to give their blood to another region.
Dr. Cecilia Nomule, who works at the Juba-based Freedom Hospital, says aside from the shortage of blood, some patients who require a blood transfusion often reject it due to cultural beliefs. She says some patients reject blood donated by someone who is not from their ethnic group. For VOA News, I am Ding Makot in Juba.
The current Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo is affecting more children. UNICEF says kids represent nearly one-third of the current total cases, compared with about 20% in previous outbreaks. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports more than 2,500 cases of Ebola in eastern Congo, including nearly 1,670 deaths. The UN Children's Fund says about 750 of those cases are children. UNICEF spokeswoman Marixi Mercado says children under age 5 are especially hard hit and account for 40% of infections. She notes an exceptionally high number of children are succumbing to the virus.
The case fatality ratio, or the number of cases who die among this group of under 5s, is 77%. That's compared with 67% among the general population, which means that young children are at higher risk than adults.
Mercado says Ebola affects children very differently from adults. Consequently, she says they need specialized care both medically and psychologically. She says children infected with Ebola receive the same drugs as adults, but they require smaller dosages. She says they also require treatment for diarrhea, against intestinal parasites, and special nutritional feeding. She says children who are separated from their parents or orphaned from Ebola need longer-term psychosocial care and support to help them get over their loss.
Virtually all of them need help to counter the debilitating effects of stigma and discrimination that taints children affected by Ebola. They need to be accepted, valued, and loved by their families and communities.
In Congo, Mercado says dedicated pediatricians provide special medical care for children in Ebola treatment centers. She says every child is assigned a dependable caregiver who also is an Ebola survivor and therefore immune to the disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still on health matters, simple things such as washing hands or brushing teeth can help prevent disease and help people enjoy healthier life. The idea of raising awareness about the health habits was an inspiration behind a Girl Scouts project that motivated one scout who ended up embarking on a passionate journey to help girls thousands of miles away. Faiza Al-Masri reports the idea for the project started out as an idea for winning Girl Scouts Gold Award. Faith Lapidus narrates her story.
Years of being a Girl Scout prepared Nyla Mpofu to serve others.
When it was time for my gold award, I was trying to think outside the box. So I decided to help girls in Zimbabwe.
The 16-year-old high school student made collection boxes available at various locations in her Virginia neighborhood for people to donate personal health products and clothes.
After that, I just started receiving donations endlessly and, like, getting the word out with my friends, and then they told, like, their parents and stuff.
Right now, we are currently getting the care packages together.
Months of generous donations resulted in mountains of daily essentials and feminine hygiene products she needed for the project.
So inside the bags, I have a toothbrush and a towel and then underwear. And when I get down to Zimbabwe, I'm going to be adding toothpaste and extra towels and pads.
Help for Others is a local nonprofit run by Nyla's mother, Gloria Mpofu.
I supported her in, you know, helping her with the flyers, just helping her to get the word out and connecting her with individuals in Zimbabwe.
Nyla traveled to Zimbabwe and met with teen girls in suburban areas, distributing the donated care packages and holding a seminar on hygiene.
They talked about how it's important, simple things as just washing hands, you know, just being able to maintain a clean environment can help, you know, the girls and the women in the communities just have a healthier lifestyle.
Nyla also gave printed information to the participants.
They can, like, look back and, like, teach it to their younger siblings or just for themselves and have knowledge about hygiene and the menstrual cycle and stuff like that.
A project that began as a way to help girls in Zimbabwe ended up showing Nyla her future potential.
And it made me realize that I could do so much and to not think lower about any situation that I'm in because of, like, taking the lead in this role and, like, planning the events and stuff like that. So it was, like, a great impact.
And the sweet memory of the trip, she says, is priceless. For writer Faiza El-Masri in Sterling, Virginia, Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. A South Sudan national security agent hauled a journalist off a plane yesterday. The editor-in-chief of the Arabic newspaper Al Watan says the NSS agent ordered him to disembark from a Kenya Airways plane and told Michael Christopher to report to NSS headquarters today. Christopher says he received no explanation as to why he was ordered to disembark. When he arrived at NSS offices today, he did not get his passport back. The media authority shut down his paper months ago after Christopher published an opinion piece about the Sudan protests. Josephine Akiro with South Sudan's Association for Media Development says there was no reason to pull Christopher off the plane. The U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan, Donald Booth, says the Trump administration is concerned about what's happening in Sudan and wants to see a tangible commitment from military leaders toward forming a civilian-led government. Booth, who met with the leader of the Sudanese Transitional Military Council last night, said Sudanese have waited far too long for change. Booth says he's in Khartoum to hear from the political parties about how they intend to move the political process forward. Military and opposition leaders agreed to a civilian-led government but have yet to sign a deal. And finally, officials in South Sudan say there is a critical shortage of blood in health facilities across the country. A technical officer with the World Health Organization in South Sudan says the country needs at least 120,000 units of blood a year, but health officials have collected only about 7,000 units. The health ministry is appealing to the public to regularly donate blood to save lives. James Chitska Chitsva, a technical officer for blood and transfusion safety at the WHO in South Sudan, says there were about 1,300 South Sudanese blood donors in 2018, but that is not nearly enough. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Sudan by Panda by a group calling itself SOB.
Yeah, SOB only. No, I know you feel the same thing I felt for Sudan. Yeah, SOB in the hood. Yeah. My homeland, S-U-D-A-N, Sudan is the biggest, smallest, greatest, poorest, richest, like a young, beautiful African girl, fell in love with hydra-headed leaders, shielded by fame and ambitions, ripped by petroleum and religions, and forsaken by all, with exception of jungle boys, Nase, Hake, Kise, Lafe, Bera.
Sudan by Panda, who came by Panda, Sudan by Panda, who came by Panda, who palgeting a party, who palgeting a party, who came by Panda, oh. Sudan by Panda, who came by Panda, Sudan by Panda, who came by Panda, who palgeting a party, who palgeting a party, who came by Panda, oh.
The Royal Quarry Mongo, it's a noble Monte Mal.
We've been listening to SOB with the song Sudan by Panda. I am John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Here and there, which loyalties, or Kokwana Ben Ken, and Haran Malacha, and Nagamal Guru Dinchin Kamal, Charan Luro Kamal, me wala jal goli, a poach kabar kakon, konum the domes of good domala, Michana Makatelukon, Lana Jacka Jomati Mal.
The gun money, they talk about money, but not to them. Damn, you better.
I'm up in tension.